Hello and welcome to Really Cool People, a podcast produced by Switzer Church. I'm your host, Jason Leininger. This is a place to hear stories of really cool people. And the hope is that in hearing their stories, you and I will be inspired, encouraged, and challenged through moments of serendipity. In a sermon entitled The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis said, "There are no ordinary people. You and I have never talked to a mere mortal." Well, it is my joy over the next few moments to introduce you to Bob Lund. He is a really cool person. Bob has got a doctorate in organizational psychology. He's married and has got two really awesome kids. And as he will unpack it for us later in the interview, he'll talk about himself as either a skeptical believer or a believing skeptic. Certainly, he's somebody who's wrestling with a lot of life's big questions. And the biggest question of all is, where is God and how is God's truth impacting the fullness of my life? So it's my joy to share with you this conversation with Bob Lund. Today, we are glad to welcome Dr. Bob Lund into the studio. And so, Bob, let's start with your story.
Well, thanks, Jason. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. It's interesting in 76 years to kind of go back over some of this, just how much has gone on and how many twists and turns have been along the way. But I was born November 18, 1947 in Beverly, Massachusetts, which is about 23 miles north of Boston on the coast. Beautiful location. I could never afford to go back there. It's become very expensive, but it was a Norman Rockwell kind of a manufacturing city, good place to be. I was a post-World War II baby, like a lot of people my age. My dad had been in the Pacific for 3.5 years. He came home. He and my mom got busy trying to build a family. Interesting thing is they had two full-term stillborn daughters before I was born. She carried two babies to term, and they were born not alive. This was in the day before much fetal monitoring, and I think it was kind of a shock when she delivered two daughters. Interesting thing is my parents never shared details or talked about those two deaths. I learned about them kind of matter-of-factly, but no evident grief, no talking about it. It wasn't a deal. So when I was born, I began to think that maybe I was kind of special to them since they had a successful live birth. And I think that's the way they treated me in my early years. I was probably, if anything, smothered with attention and love until I had a brother born after me 3 years later. I would say I had a Norman Rockwell childhood, pretty much. We rented a tenement apartment in a neighborhood that had a lot of police officers in it, which was a lot of fun. We didn't have much money starting out, but I don't remember ever wanting for anything. We lived frugally, but my parents provided really well. We were the third generation at Dane Street Congregational Church, a place that I still hold close to my heart. In those days, there was one senior pastor and at some point an associate pastor for youth programs. But my dad was the Sunday school superintendent for my entire childhood. It was an unpaid position, and he recruited and staffed all the Sunday schools and did all of that in addition to his day job. My mom was a kitchen lady, was always reliable as a volunteer and always in the kitchen serving for anything that was going on. I had an early brief brush with polio, which was not uncommon in the early 50s, very mild. I was paralyzed for a short period of time, and to the great alarm of my parents, that's something they did talk about with me. And as was true in some cases, it passed really without a definitive diagnosis, but it scared the dickens out of them. My mom, one early memory I have that's kind of interesting because it relates to later life is when my mom grocery shopped, she had to walk to the grocery store and she would stand me on the counter, the checkout counter at the grocery store, and I would sing for half an hour to anybody who was coming and going. including the owner of the store, while she did her shopping. I don't remember that, but she's told that story a number of times, and I think that may be why I became a blabbermouth some of my later professional encounters. At age 9, we moved to a nicer neighborhood that my dad had always aspired to live in and to own, although we did rent. We didn't own a home for quite some time. So I switched elementary schools in the middle. Kind of a feature of childhood that maybe we can come back to later if it's interesting, is I was very heavy. I was a fat kid. And in that respect, I was bullied and pushed around and beaten up and mocked and otherwise abused, not by adults, but by peers. And I remember those days really pretty well. I also, for some reason, never got above a C or a D grade in elementary school, very poorly. I was constantly being sent out of the classroom for speaking out, acting out, being verbal, which again predicts certain things later in life. But yeah, my mother was constantly in parent-teacher conferences and, you know, what's wrong with your son and he's not performing and blah, blah, blah. Things hit a 180 in the eighth grade. There were 635 kids in my class in this particular city in Beverly, and we all had to take an IQ test. I remember not thinking very much about it, but several weeks after that, one of the teachers pulled me aside and said, do you have any idea how well you did on the test? And I said, what do you mean well on the test? And apparently I had done well on the test. And it's interesting because those data got shared with all the teachers in the school, and all of a sudden, they looked at me differently. You know, I wasn't the dumb kid. I wasn't the troublesome kid. I wasn't the, you know, maybe he's actually, you know, on the more skillful end. I won't say gifted because I didn't look at it that way. But all of a sudden, that changed. And some teachers took interest in me, one male teacher, and he recruited me into the local DMLA chapter, which was a big deal in New England at the time. That's kind of a junior Masonic endeavor. And I went out for football. I went on a growth spurt. I went from fat to trim. Life just turned around. And it went from what I would call kind of miserable in the elementary ages to really a nice teenage years. I got involved in the Red Cross on a disaster recovery team, which my mother didn't care for because we would get calls in the middle of the night to go to 5-alarm fires and serve coffee to the firemen and that kind of stuff. I loved it. Became a water safety instructor, was involved in Boy Scout leadership. Again, the Order of DMLA, which was important to me. Brass bands, chorus. I was president of the church fellowship. And a funny thing, in that regard, is the guidance counselors at the time kept telling me, you need to become a minister. That's what you need to do, you become a pastor. And I think that was I think that was very bad advice. I would have been terrible. I think they were just going off the halo idea that I was a good public speaker and I would get up and give talks and do that kind of thing. But the idea that at that point in time I had the spiritual gifts or the patience or any of the required attributes were not there, but that was the suggestion that I become a minister, go to seminary, and so forth. When it came time to pick a college, I had a couple of choices. The Air Force Academy was one. A not really super competitive school in Pennsylvania was the other. And then where I wound up, Williams College was a third option for me. And Williams at the time was very, very competitive and selective. And I was really afraid to do it. And I was struggling up until the night I had to make a choice. I went to my associate pastor's house. And I trusted this guy, and I said, "What do you have any advice for me at all how to make this decision?" And he said, "You know, if you take the less competitive venue, you'll always wonder, could you have gone to the more competitive venue and been successful? You'll always wonder. And he said, that's the only advice. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just telling you, I predict you'll regret if you don't take a risk, take the leap. So I did. I did terribly my first 2 years. It was a very competitive place with highly privileged kids, and I felt kind of overwhelmed. But I caught fire in the whole area of psychology. Once I got into that major, I really was on fire to understand how people and groups and organizations work. Had an opportunity to do a thesis with one of the professors who was a mentor to me, and we published it. And the lesson I got out of that was, maybe I can compete in the big leagues. Maybe I can take some risks and really stretch myself out there. My draft number, it was the height of the Vietnam War when I graduated. My draft number was 147, so I was going to be going. And I got a one-year teaching deferment at Mount Holyoke College, which is a girls' school nearby, in their psych department, and actually wound up working for one of the nation's intelligence agencies, which I'm not allowed to mention, on a project, in a very junior role on this project, teaching pigeons how to guide missiles by looking at a screen and pecking different areas of you can't make this stuff up. Can't make it up. At the time, I was trying to figure out what to do about the draft, and I knew I wanted to find a way to serve. I wasn't a conscientious objector. I wanted a way to serve that involved saving lives rather than taking lives, and it looked like maybe the medical arena was a way to do that. So I got a commission in the Army Medical Service Corps, which is, those of you who know Jim Mason know that that's how he served as well, something we have, the two of us have in common. I had 4 days of active duty in the Army before they sent me home because I'd torn up a knee in a way that disqualified me from military duty right about the same time. And at that point, I had applied to Duke for health administration school, thinking, well, this is a way to deal with the military issue. So I wound up at Duke and had lots of adventures there, kind of a risk to move away from New England and go to someplace completely different. I met a medical technologist there and married her, which was a first marriage. And I'll kind of run through what I had for some jobs along the way and then get to Schweitzer. But my first job right out of grad school was director of a community mental health center, which fitted with my interest in psychology and some background I'd had in helping folks with drug issues and those kinds of things. I was 25. I was supervising psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, chaplains. I was in way over my head, had no idea what I was doing. Probably barely survived. And after about 4 years, I thought, I need to know more. I am obviously not feeling comfortable in this role. So I went back down to North Carolina and went to Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina, for a PhD in business. And it was organizational behavior was the specialty, was kind of a combination of social psych and industrial psych. So it really fit what my interests were. By the time I finished the PhD, I knew what I wanted to do someday was to run a health administration program. I wanted to be the director of a program. And I decided I would do that when I was 50. And it's the only thing I have ever planned in life that came out as I thought it might. The only plan I ever made. All the rest of my plans have been folly. But that one actually came to pass. I got a waiver from the Navy. They said they would take me with a bad knee, and I got a commission in the Medical Service Corps in the Navy, and actually did that for about 13 years and got called to active duty for Desert Storm. I was involved in that for a brief period of time and retired as a lieutenant commander. Didn't retire really, but I got out of the service as a lieutenant commander, and I value those years. That was a terrific sense of mission and camaraderie, and that I share with other vets. So, went on to become executive director of a Center for Health, Fitness, and Human Performance, University of Massachusetts Med Center, which was a really interesting combination of psychiatry and Zen and orthopedics and cardiology and fitness. And we had contracts with the Boston Red Sox and all the Harvard teams. It was a great fun, terrible job, but it was great fun. I went from there to be the chief administrator at University of Florida Clinic in Gainesville. That's 425 doctors. Did that for 7 years. Went on to be the chief operating officer at Emory University, Pediatric Care Foundation there. It's 125 doctors. Did that for a couple of years and then became a vice chair in the Department of Medicine at East Carolina Med School. That was 85 doctors. So you kind of see the pattern here, was working to help physicians with their practices, faculty practice plans. And again, it's sort of like there was a 180. I was okay at that. I wasn't particularly gifted at doing that kind of work. I was never really happy. I experienced a lot of joy doing it. I wasn't depressed. I got it done. I made a lot of money. But it wasn't, you know, wasn't where God wanted me. Then at age 50, just as I had hoped and planned, there was an opportunity that came up here in Springfield to come and start up a health administration grad program from scratch. And because no one really wanted that job, because they had to do it from scratch, I was able to negotiate some privileges that made the job too good to pass up. So I came out here, and that was, you know, I thank God, that was finding a sweet spot. I've had more joy probably here in Springfield and enjoyed more personal success and feeling of getting important things done, probably more of that here than anywhere. Came to Schweitzer right off the bat when we moved to town and got involved in Stephen Ministry, especially. One of the first classes to go through Stephen Ministry training with Lori Lampert, who was here at the time. Jim Mason was in that class with me. We became close. I've done that for 25 years now, caring ministries, hospital visits. It's psychology. It's what I was originally hoping to do. And it kind of came to pass, the opportunity to do a certain amount of that, to come alongside people. I teach currently in kind of specializing in grief, loss, and loneliness. Sounds like kind of a bummer, but we started doing that again with Jim and Lori and others, and now Sheila Pippin, and it's been there's no lack of demand for classes in that area here in the church, and we've been pretty busy with that. And finally, I'll sort of land the plane here. The most recent thing I've been doing, two recent things, is I've been able to chair the board at Cox College, which is a big nursing school here. It has about 900 students. And I've been a chairman of the board there and currently on the board. And then this year, I'm chairing a thing called the Institute for Lifelong Learning, which is a group of curious people that meet every week, 40 weeks a year, to hear from speakers in all kinds of different areas. And that's over at Drury University. And again, it sort of fits with patterns that I saw in my early life, Jason, that seemed to, I got off the path maybe a little bit and eventually found my way back to where I think God has me programmed.
And one of the things I love about hearing people's stories is I often know names, faces for sure, but then there's so much behind a name and a face that just is incredible about people. And so there's a lot of, I mean, I knew a few of these things along the way, but so much of this is just, it's a real gift to hear the journey that you've been on and where you're at now. Your parents, you said, treated you as special. Then your brother came along. What was that relationship like that you had with your brother? And how have the two of you gone through life together, especially with, I mean, in under the shadow of whether they ever named it or not, a great deal of grief?
I would think so. And let me lead by saying I haven't spoken to my brother in 35 years. Neither of us has spoken to the other. Not entirely my choice, so you've really hit on touched a nerve. I think that's important. We got along fine. We were 3 years apart, which I have read is not an ideal spread. 3 years seems to be the point at which maybe siblings don't get along particularly well. I've read that. I don't know if that's true. I think in our early years, we got along. My brother always felt very competitive with me, that he had to do everything that I did. And the interesting thing is he did, and he did me one better every step along the way. He was a gifted athlete. I was not. He did a little bit better in school. I was not. He went to Dartmouth on a football scholarship. I went to Williams on a more of a music scholarship. You name it. He was the president of everything I was the president of. Later on, when he got into some issues and problems of his own, he would tell my parents, you always favored Bob, yeah, Bobby. You always favored Bobby and not me, which I don't think was true at all. I don't have any sense of that. But we were never close. And I think it was his desire to compete with me rather than I wasn't particularly conscious of what he was up to. At the time my dad died, there were some issues around settling my dad's modest estate. Maybe the more modest they are sometimes, the more issues they can be. Anyway, harsh words were said in both directions. And my brother actually has disowned the entire family. He doesn't talk to anybody, any of our cousins, any aunts and uncles, anybody. He took off. I could go more into that, but that's all about him, and he's got his own. He's got his issues. Yeah.
Wow.
So I don't know if that had anything to do with my parents. I'm sure they were grieving over having lost two babies, but I don't know.
And then you mentioned about that you found out matter-of-factly, but not with a lot of unpacking of that.
No unpacking.
And then you end up in the world of psychology, which is known for unpacking everything. Is that connected? Is that?
It's interesting that you've prepared me that you might ask, what would you do if you had it to do all over again? Or who would you sit down with if you had it to do all over again? And I would sit with my parents. I was close to them and became close to them and had very loving relationships, especially toward the end of their lives. I didn't push them on it. I didn't push them on unpacking things that they didn't want to unpack. And I think I would do that now because that had to have been a horrible situation for them. But now they just, I think my mother told me at one point, well, I had two babies and they were both stillborn, full term. And that was it. No, nowadays people they'll bless them. They'll have communion. They'll hold them. They'll bury them somewhere and nothing, nothing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, what was your dad in World War II?
He was a chief petty officer in the Seabees, and he was over in the Pacific island hopping. And you name the place, Bougainville, Solomon Islands, Okinawa, Iwo Jima, all those different places. He would come in behind the Marines, he and his unit, and they would build an airfield. So their job was to build things. And he was there. He got to come home at one point when my mom was pregnant with one of the babies that didn't survive. And they brought him home, I think, for that briefly. But then he was 3.5 years over there. And he came back. One thing he did share with me was some of the trauma of all that was that he determined at that point he would try to make the world a better place. And there's a yin and a yang to that. I'll share with you because it'll tell you a little bit about who I am. We never saw my dad. He was in every service club in town. He was the superintendent of the Sunday school. He was president of the Lions Club. He was president of Kiwanis. He was in a fuel society that charitably gave fuel to people that didn't have it, you know, oil in the winter. And you name it, he was in it. And he was gone every night of the week. He'd come home from work and he'd grab supper and then he was gone. Two things I learned about that. One I learned as he got older and shared with me was he wanted to do that in some ways because he came back from the war kind of on fire to make the world a better place. On the other hand, it became clear that he didn't want to be home. And I've understood some things about that as time has gone on. I love my dad. Hugely grateful to him. But like all of us, he was broken in certain ways. And the way in which he was broken was he couldn't handle conflict of any kind, didn't want to deal with it. If my mother had an issue with him, he would turn around on his heel and walk away. And she would be left crying and, you know, upset. He just couldn't deal with it. And until it hit a certain point, a couple of times in my childhood when the belt came out, you know, for things I'd really done that were really bad. But generally, he just couldn't deal with it. And I think his way of not dealing with two loud boys at home was not to be at home. It's interesting. We're not here to talk about your parents, but talk about mine. But you find out later on, for all the good, there's often things that you wish had been different about them.
Yeah.
And at the end, when you wrap it all up, and I had to do this in the times of their deaths, when you wrap it all up, you have to come to terms and say, I accept what was the good and the not so good. It's what is, what was. And the net of it was my dad was an outstanding man of great integrity. And the bit about service rubbed off to some extent on me, but the neglecting the kids I did a 180 on that.
Yeah, so you've got two kids.
Two kids.
So how did your 180 look different with your own kids?
Yeah, you know, some of it, we had our kids late, Alice and I, and the point at which most people are becoming grandparents, we had kids, and we're blessed to have been able to do that and have healthy kids. And I had been, to some extent, afraid, and I think Alice also, kind of afraid to have kids, wondering if we were up to it. Then we made a decision, again, kind of a toward the end of the window of opportunity that we're going to do this. I had changed careers by then. I'd come out here to Missouri State, or I was about to come out here to Missouri State. And I was in a job that was much less demanding than the prior jobs. And that was A, by design, and B, a blessing, because I had plenty of time for the kids and could take time off for their various things and, you know, loved on them like crazy. And they've turned out to be fine human beings, and you know we've been so lucky. But no, not like my dad. I wasn't going to do that.
Your kids are fantastic. Had the joy of meeting both of them, and skilled in lots of ways. And they're great kids, great young adults.
One of them is not a follower. And one of them is on fire, and our daughter's always been deeply kind of invested in her spiritual life. My son, not so, but he's still a guy of character. And sometimes I know there are a lot of people at Schweitzer who grieve about a kid maybe who is not actively involved in the church. But I think sometimes no matter what you do as a parent, they have their own wiring. You don't want to make somebody do something that they, in the realm of spirituality, that they're not equipped to do.
That's why, as Methodist, I think prevenient grace is one of those things that holds us or speaks into our lives in those moments. The reality that God is wooing in God's way, and God has a way with us when we'd like to draw some other ways, but.
Yep. The opportunity is the opportunity's there. Mm-hmm. God doesn't close the door.
Uh-uh. Back to your childhood for a little bit. You said as a kid that you were a heavy kid and you took abuse by your peers. And then you went on to say that that has really been unforgettable in your life. How has that shaped, you know, and then obviously things flipped when you were in high school. But how has that shaped other aspects of your life?
Tell you a quick story. My first year going to Boy Scout camp, age 11, camp was run by a former Marine who had certain ideas about how it should work. And one of those ideas was that the older scouts would haze the brand new scouts. Mm-hmm. And by hazing, I mean real physical abuse. Mm-hmm. And so some of that went on, and it was, you know, bordering on even, it wasn't quite sexual abuse, but it was sort of bordering on that kind of thing that boys will do to boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty traumatized by that. I was already a fat kid that didn't feel very capable. And the idea was when you came back for your second year or third year, then you would turn around and beat up on the other kids. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't. And I was one of the few, you know, they'd say, Lon, you know, get in and help. Give this kid a pink belly, you know, and do this and do that. Mm-mm. And I think the way it's impacted me is I was once when I was at UNC working on my doctorate, I went to a football game, and there was one of the lesser known state schools was there. And these kids had crummy uniforms and the band, all that stuff. And everybody in the stands was laughing at them. I went back 20 years later to teach at that school. You know, I've got mm-hmm. a heart for the underdog, and mm-hmm. you can tell. People that are being abused, beat up, marginalized, made to feel lonely, all comes from there. All comes mm-hmm. from the very beginning. You know, I felt blessed that somehow the luck of genetics, I mean, I became more rather than less attractive. I became more capable rather than less. I became confident in some areas rather than less. But no, you don't forget that. I didn't forget it. And mm-hmm. I didn't let it turn me into a monster either. You know, I think the whole Alice and I are giving some money this year to the Kilties. Have you ever heard of the Kilties?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They need uniforms. And these kids don't have money. You know, this is Central mm-hmm. High kids. And the minute that call came out, I thought, I can help with that. You know, they need it. And, you know, the kid who's the son of a doctor somewhere doesn't need that kind of help. They have the privilege out of the gate. Well, that's what that's about. You can tell I'm passionate about it.
You are passionate. Yeah, it's hard to forget those moments. When the soul is tender and the wound is severe, the soul carries that.
Yeah. And it's a blessing that one toughens up to over time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully one does. I did.
So when you took that IQ test, did you ever find out what your IQ was?
I was number 4 out of 635. So I don't know what they never told me what that means, but I was able to look it up and do the math. I don't feel that way. I don't feel that way. I'm a good test taker, and I'm not minimizing it, but I am a good test taker. I did much better at taking tests than I did at achieving in the classroom, and that's all the way through from beginning mm-hmm. to even through the PhD program. The people would look at my transcript and say, you know, well, not so sure. And then they'd look at the test score and say, well, okay. Yeah.
You said your teachers looked at you differently. Did, and then you also mentioned that as you got closer to college, people were saying, maybe you ought to be a minister, maybe you ought to do this. So, I mean, it sounds like it wasn't just teachers, but that there was a real shift in your environment where people started to have expectations for you or from you. How do you think that sense of expectation helped to shift, you know, and cause that sense of 180 or propel it beyond maybe where it would have gone?
Yeah. You know, I think some of it was people would say, well, you come from a good family because my dad was highly respected. He was out there, and my mom. And so that was that kind of expectation. And I don't know, you know, it's for a number of years, I don't see myself as having many gifts, but I see myself as having a few. And the ability to teach, the ability to listen, come alongside somebody. There are things I can't do at all. I wouldn't want to be executive pastor and have your job and be responsible for all the people in the organization. I've done that, and I'm not all that good at it. So I don't know if it was expectation or just kind of having a sweet spot. Our high school group, fellowship, we went out to see Andover Newton Theological Seminary, went up for a visit there, spent a day. And I kind of fell in love with the place. And I thought, you know, this is maybe what I need to do. But what I now realize was what I wasn't in love with was the idea of being a pastor and what that entails. I thought, boy, to come here and be able to read and study and really get into the depth of all this would really be great. And these folks are all kind of on a mission. They are all kind of pushing in the same direction, and would have been great. I don't know. It's been a process of discovery to figure out what are the couple things that, you know, what am I sort of good at, and that's what God, you know, God wants me to go with that.
Uh huh. Well, you mentioned that too when you were talking about your career. Like, there were these jobs you had where you said, you're like, I'm okay, but I'm not happy. I'm not, that's sad, but I'm you know, going through the motions. But you know, that sense of finding your sweet spot.
Right, right. And there were signals at several points along the way. My first marriage ended in divorce, a very bad situation. And, you know, there were red flags, but before we got married, I didn't see them or chose to ignore them, I think, as some people do, that went, you know, this isn't right and shouldn't go this way. And there were early indications. When I was working on my PhD, we had to teach as part of the program. You go teach undergrads. And my ratings were really pretty good. And I sort of knew at the time, hey, you know, this feels right. I can be successful at it. The students seem to like it. It's fun. But I kind of didn't go that way. You know, I went off into these executive roles. They can be kind of seductive. And I think I knew early on the sweet spot was teaching. And it took me forever to land, took half my career to land there. And I still, you know, I guess I could say, God, why, you know, why did you poke me? God did poke me. Gave me plenty of green flags, you know, that said, over here.
So in thinking about your own vocational journey, how have you used that to speak life into your kids? Or maybe other students that you know, that you've had in the classroom?
Both of my kids have kind of gone the direction they want to go. And but all along the way, my message to them was, find out something you're good at that brings joy, and then find where that connects to the needs of the world. You know, that's a cliche. I didn't make that up.
It's not a cliche, and no, you did make that up.
Not a cliche, no, but yeah. I didn't make it up. A lot of people have said that, you know, find where joy intersects with the needs of the world. And every time I would notice that they seem to be getting some joy or showing some skill at something, I want to sort of encourage that without driving it. You know, mm-hmm. you have to do this. So why are you? Well, you could do something with this. You could do something with that. And I still do it. I send them stuff. Mm-hmm. They're now 30 and 27. And I still send them stuff all the time saying, here's a boy, you know, given what you've done and accomplished, wouldn't this be an interesting mm-hmm. Sort of thing? Crickets. Crickets. You know, they're tired of hearing it. But with my students along the way, really anybody that I was going to counsel, I'd say, gee, listen carefully for the Holy Spirit. Listen, because not everybody claims they have encounters with the Holy Spirit. I think I've had four. And I was sharing these with Bob Cassidy one day, and he said, let's see if those are really authentic. And he thought maybe three of them were. But no, there've been three. It's not like an everyday thing, but there have been three times in my life when I received a word, mm-hmm. and it wasn't anything I would possibly have thought up myself. I mean, it was, wow, you know, mm-hmm. was not a hallucination. And I'll say to people and students and others is if God is guiding you and you're getting a message to head in one direction or another, listen carefully to it. I listened to it and then didn't go with it early enough. Mm. Is that a problem? No, this prevenient grace.
Right.
So, yeah. It was always there. And I found a sweet spot,
mm-hmm.
my sweet spot. Found the right spouse, perfect mm-hmm. for me. Found the right occupation. You know, the kids are fine. They're self-confident. They're on their own. Mm-hmm. They don't ask me for advice. They know better. So there you go.
I think one of the things that you may be, I guess it's other people's story to tell. You've oftentimes stepped in into holes and filled holes when organizations and other people really had a need, and you've been there for other folks, and it's much appreciated.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
You talked a lot about how the Lord's been part of your life, and before we started, a couple other places, you mentioned that, well, you haven't said it in quite these terms, but it's reminded me of almost like a Jacob moment where you're wrestling a bit with God these days. And I don't know if you want to talk about that or explore some of that.
Yeah, yeah. It was really after my early childhood was kind of standard, what you learn in Sunday school. And like a lot of people, like got away from that in the 20s. And then when we had kids and started bringing them here to Schweitzer, I was 40-ish, and became interested. I was never really interested in questioning what truth is or what a transcendent God is all about. And after I retired, I had from free time to begin to study probably what you studied in seminary and other places. I was kind of charting my own course. So I took a course by Bart Ehrman, who's at University of Florida. He's a former Christian, no longer. And now he teaches in a religion department rather than a theology group. And he's a critic. And he kind of unpacks and deconstructs a lot of what's in the Bible and says, what do we mm-hmm. know is true? Anyway, he's one side of it. And, I was never heard some of this stuff before, you know, the historical Jesus versus the faith Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So then I took a course by Luke Timothy Johnson, who is a Catholic and a Christian and a believer. And he's coming at it the other way. But again, from an intellectual, literary point of view, what's the Bible really all about? How literal is it? And then I'm listening to Adam Hamilton talk about his colander and, you know, how do you read the Bible? I've read his book on that.
Yeah.
So the more I get into it, and I have wrestled, Jason, and I'm in a band group with a couple of guys, one guy in particular. We talk about this kind of thing a lot and our doubts, and we've read Brian McLaren and you name it. And we've read some apologetic
mm-hmm.
Work as well. So here I am at 76, and what I currently wrestle with, and it is a Jacob wrestle, is there's a lot of history that may or may not be, it could be true, but it may not be accurate.
Yep.
A lot of that. And then there's faith. There's a choice to have faith. And I heard Spencer say in a sermon one time, oh, and it wasn't in a sermon, it was in an email he sent me. He said, when I die, I want to know about the transcendent God, you know, and the mystery. I think where he put it was the mystery of the transcendent God. Well, that's kind of where I am. I've studied cosmology. I've studied anthropology now. I've studied some science and physics and some philosophy. And it all makes me more confused and more questioning. Talked to Jim Mason about it. He said, you just have to hold all this in dynamic tension. What the devil does that mean? So I'll sum up. But here's what I am now, where I am now. The truth, the nugget, where my heart is here. It's with people like you and others that are mentors, friends, and colleagues. I don't reject anything. I'm just wrestling with what to believe. And from that, where does faith go? I don't think we can understand a great deal about God, and that's where maybe I differ with folks who have more faith. God is transcendent. To the extent we're created in His image is still something I'm messing around with in my own head. But unlike a couple of atheist friends, I believe the truth is here. It's right in front of me. I want to be more aware. I want to get closer. And if I'm making a mistake, Jason, it's probably because I'm doing this as a head trip, maybe than as opposed to a heart trip, but yeah. And I have 3 artificial hips. So Jacob, the angel, has dislocated me several times.
There's a story. It may be a bit of mythology about Karl Barth when he was on a journey here in the States, lectures series. And this was after most of his writings had already been published. They said, somebody said, Dr. Barth, you know, they didn't say Dr. Barth because he didn't have a doctorate. I said, Professor, what have you come to really know in your being after all this writing? And he said, this much I know. Jesus loves me. This I know, for the Bible tells me so. And he had landed on that's what he could be certain of. And that was enough.
Yeah, one person I like to read is Frederick Buechner, who's now deceased, and he describes himself as a believing skeptic and a skeptical believer, both. He said he's got that intention, and the skeptical believer part is me. I believe. God help me with my unbelief. I'm still wrestling with the details, you know.
Well, that makes you a good disciple, because Thomas did too.
Yeah, yeah. Could do worse.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, let's end on a high note.
Yeah.
A couple of high notes. What are you looking forward to this next 6 months or year? What's on your docket, your calendar?
Ooh, I want to get back to activity again and heal up my fractured leg. And because I like to stay active and get back to that and travel around. See people and go places. I'm looking forward to that. Staying alive at a certain age.
Don't fall over.
That's right. Just stay vertical.
That's right.
Use the cane. No, I am looking forward. I'm an immensely curious guy. It's a fault, if anything, I want to learn more. Mm-hmm. Become more aware, and there's much yet to go, hopefully, in years as well.
Yes.
As growth.
Yeah. Oh, a final question I like to ask folks. What's a final word of advice you'd like to share? Maybe it's something that you've had shared with you, but maybe it's something that you found yourself sharing with other people along the way.
Well, we already talked about kind of listening for the still small voice, you know, mm-hmm. listening for the prompts about what to do. I laughed. My dad was a John Philip Sousa fan, and I became one too, because we mm-hmm. both played. And he used to say, be kind to your web-footed friend, because that duck may be somebody's mother. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? Excuse my, what are you talking about? And he said, there's always a backstory. Mm-hmm. And it, I think if I were to give advice to anybody that sums it up is, be kind to everybody, listen, don't judge prematurely. You never know what's back there. You've heard a little bit about what's back there with me, and you've got your stories, I'm sure. Everybody has a story. We're all broken in some mm-hmm. ways, or gifted in some ways, and sometimes we're delightfully surprised, too. Yeah. That's the advice
Thank
I'd
you.
Conclude with.
Thank you. This has been very delightful, a real cherished joy. I'm always honored to hear this part of your story. The stories that are shared, because many surprises and God's goodness, God's presence is showing up in many places. And yours is a beautiful life. It's a good
life. Thank you. Thank you. It's been a privilege to be here. I've enjoyed talking with you. Yeah.
Well, a big, big thank you to Bob for sharing his story. And listening to Bob, I hope you were inspired, encouraged, and challenged. And that you begin to behold and listen and hear the stories of the really cool people that are around you. The Really Cool People podcast is produced by Schweitzer Church, Springfield, Missouri. Taylor Likes is the executive producer and editor, and I'm your host, Jason Leininger. You can help us by liking, reviewing, and sharing this podcast. And until next time, stay cool!